Good morning, I'm Karen Cloperdans, and I read the Bible every now and then. 1 Corinthians 9, 19 through 27. For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew, in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified.
Thanks, Karen. Well, my name is Zach Thompson, and it is a joy to gather with you all this morning, primarily so that we can worship together, but there is that fringe benefit of getting to do so where there is heat and an abundance of coffee, especially on a morning like today. We are working through the book of 1 Corinthians together, and where we find ourselves in a lengthy, but connected argument that the Apostle Paul is making. Paul is one who's been sent by Jesus to plant churches, and he planted this church in Corinth. He cares about this place. He teaches them. He guides them, especially in situations like the one that they're in. They are in a disagreement, and they're disagreeing over the right to eat meat that has been sacrificed to idols. Not so often, not a disagreement we tend to have in the modern church, but the roots of it, the responses, the reasons behind the argument sure look like a lot of disagreements within the church. You have one camp that says, we have this right. We have all the reason in the world to eat this meat. After all, it was sacrificed to an idol as part of a worship service. Idols aren't anything, so it's not a big deal. What they did to the meat beforehand, as long as it's still edible and delicious, it's fine to eat afterwards. Second, there's no other place to go. If we want to eat meat, we have to buy this meat that's been sold by these temples. And the third, this is just what we do in the city. We don't need to find a deeper meaning behind it. This is just what we're used to. But for other people in the church, they mostly come out of a background of worshiping false gods, worshiping idols, by eating this meat that was sacrificed to them. So for them to see their fellow Christian, their fellow brother and sister in Christ, to eat this meat that has been used to worship other gods, that's a problem. It might cause them to go against their conscience. It might cause them to actively sin themselves. And that is damaging to them. That's damaging to the church. That's damaging to the person who ate the meat. Even though they have every reason to, all the right in the world to insist upon this, Paul still says they're wrong because they're not considering their fellow Christian. They should be willing to give up these rights for the sake of the gospel. Now, Paul talks all the time about the gospel. It's a word that just means good news, and Paul regularly tells us what this good news is. I think of another letter that he wrote to a church in Rome. In Romans 1, 16 through 17, he writes, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is," he's telling us what the gospel is, "the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and then also to the Greek, to the Gentile, to those who are not Jewish. For in it," in the gospel, "the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it's written, the righteous shall live by faith." So Paul is saying the gospel, the good news, is the saving work of Jesus for all people. That in it, the righteousness of God, his perfection, and the perfect life that he calls us to is shown to us, that is given to us from faith for faith. I know that's kind of a tricky phrase, but I think what Paul is saying, that this life that we have, the Christian life, exists entirely because of faith, of trusting, of believing in this gospel. But this life that we're called to live in response to that, that is done entirely by faith. Faith is the reason why we are Christians. Faith is the reason why we're able to live as Christians. He's saying that the Christian life is done solely by the saving work of Jesus. And as we seek to live faithfully in response to that, that is a life not done from our own power and abilities, but is driven by faith in the gospel. It's important that we get those 2 points. We are saved by faith and we live by faith, because that is the point that Paul is going to make in our chapter, in our passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. That is the gospel. And because it's so earth-shattering, all-encompassing, that Jesus has done this for us, this good news of the good work of Jesus to save us, that changes everything. That completely shapes and guides our lives to the point that Paul is making in this argument, we don't hold on to anything as if it interferes with the gospel. Nothing should interfere with the gospel. Nothing that we hold on to should interfere with the gospel. So 2 weeks ago, he made the point that because of the gospel, we should care more about our fellow Christians, people in the church, than any right, any privilege, anything that is due to us. None of that is more important than our fellow brother and sister in Christ. Last week, he made the point that I have rights. There are things that I could claim, and yet I don't do this, because nothing that we hold on to, nothing we prioritize, should be placed above the gospel. But now he pushes this argument a little bit further as well. And he goes beyond the walls of the church. And he says, because of the gospel, our desire, what we aim for, what we look for in life, should be to see all believe in this gospel. All trust in the saving work of Jesus as well. Paul writes here that if we have experienced the saving work, this good news, if we have seen that the gospel truly is good for us, then our aim, what we look for in life should be letting go. That though we have things that we can claim, we have things that are ours by right, or a privilege that we might have, or things that we can claim as mine, Paul says our desire ought to be to let go of these things for the sake of other people knowing this gospel truth as well. And he makes this point in 1 Corinthians 9, 19. He says, "For though I am free from all, I've made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them." Paul is wrapping up this argument. He says, I have rights. I have things that I can claim. You in Corinth, I could say that you owe me something, that I can say this is mine. I am free. And yet, not only do I not claim these rights, do I not make use of them? I lower myself for the sake of other people. It's not just that I'm not exercising my rights to things. I'm actively looking to meet other people's preferences for the good of others, even at the expense of myself. Even though I'm free, I've made myself a servant, which is right at the edge, so it's hard to circle. I've made myself a servant. And Paul illustrates what this looks like through 4 different groups of people. He says, when I'm with the Jews, when I'm with Jewish people, well, I become Jewish. I'm going to eat kosher meals, even though as a Christian, I'm free. I don't have to limit my diet to this. I'm going to follow the customs of these people that I'm with, even though because of Jesus, I've been freed from some of these customs. Though being with these Jews, I have the right to insist upon a different menu. I have the right to not give up the freedoms that's been given to me in Christ. I'm still going to do this. I'm going to do what it is that these people are looking for, what their preferences are, what their expectations for the sake of the gospel. He goes a little bit further and he talks about those who are under the law. And this is talking about those who hold the rigorous customs that God gave to the Israelites in the Old Testament, oftentimes adding beyond what God gave to preserve these laws. He's not saying that we're doing away with all that God has commanded. Later on, notice he says law quite a bit there. His point in that is saying, I'm not getting rid of all of God's law. I'm still under the law of Christ. I'm still under what God calls all people to do. But these extra practices, these rigorous customs from the Old Testament, I've been freed from those. I don't have to keep them. But when I'm with people who do, I'm going to wash my hands. I'm going to obey the purity laws. I'm going to keep the feasts. Even though I have no need to do so as a Christian, I'm free, I'm still going to maintain these things for the sake of the gospel. On the other side, those who are not Jewish, those who are outside the law, I'm going to be like them. They have their own customs and practices, so I'm not going to ask them to provide me with a kosher meal like I grew up eating, Paul would have said. I'm not going to stop the meal to pray to a God that they don't know or don't believe. They have their own customs, and so I'm going to do what they're doing. I'm literally doing as the Romans do. And then finally, to the weak. Now, this is a group of people in the church. We read about them earlier in chapter 8. And Paul's talking about them as if their understanding in Jesus is not giving them this sense of freedom. Maybe to the point of they don't understand who Jesus is. They could be in the church. They could be hearing all the things that are going on and still miss out on who Jesus is. And for the sake of the gospel, for them trusting in him, I'm going to surrender rights that I have. And this whole argument about eating meat, I'm not going to eat this meat. I'm not going to do anything that might put up an obstacle for the gospel that will get in the way of them believing what Jesus has done for them. And Paul tells us exactly why he does this. The surrendering of rights, surrendering of things that are due to him, of preferences, of things that he likes, of why it's worth it to give up all of these for the sake of others. In verse 19, he says, I've made myself a servant of all that I might win more of them. And then later on in verse 22, that I've become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some of them. That I give up these things that I am due, that are mine by right, so that I might win some of them, so that I might save some of them. Well, win what? Save from what? Well, this is the gospel that we keep banging the drum about because Paul won't stop talking about the gospel. That in it, this good news of the good work that Jesus has done to save us, we see what it is that we've been saved from. Paul is sent to help others see this. That is what winning looks like, to know this truth. But the saving work is done entirely by Jesus, that by him coming and dying a death that he did not deserve, by taking our place, he has brought salvation. He saves us from sin. That all of us have turned away from the perfect God that we were meant to be with, that we have cut ourselves off from life as it was meant to be lived, which is with God, and we have been rescued from that instead. He saves us from death. That's the sure future of every single person who experiences sin, which we read about is all people. Rather than life with God, our future is death, and yet Jesus saves us from that. He saves us from punishment. That the response of us going away from this God is punishment. Rather than this perfect life with this perfect God, we now have punishment for this rebellion. And yet Jesus saves us from that, who gives us a perfect future and a perfect reality that we live out of now, which we celebrate as a reality all the things that we talk about at Christmas. Our lives are marked by hope and joy and peace and love because we have been saved by this Jesus. And Paul is saying that is why I'm willing to lay aside everything else, because nothing is more important than the gospel. So the expectation is I'm not going to expect non-Christians to adjust to me, to try to behave properly, to expect them to know just instinctually all the good Christian things that they're supposed to do. I'm going to go to them, and I'm going to act as they do. I'm going to be what they're used to as a way to build a bridge for the gospel, as a way to bring the context of this truth to where they are. I'm going to adjust to them to not put any obstacle up to them hearing this good news that was done for them as well. Let me show an example of what this looks like when it's not done. I went on a missions trip to Arizona. We went to a Navajo reservation that was there. It was just a small group of us. We were all leaders from the middle school. We were seeing, is it appropriate next year to bring some of the middle school students with us to go on this trip? And so we mostly spent time in the town that they had on the reservation. That's where the church was, and we were working out of there. Sometimes we did some repairs at people's houses for those who already attended the church, but it was mostly focused on how can we just support the church with what they're already doing. One day, though, we did take a drive out to the hills that were kind of in the surrounding areas, and we met with this, for lack of a better word, a clan. They were part of the tribe, but they shunned anything modern. And so that meant they didn't go into town. And it also meant that they didn't have anything to do with the church whatsoever. The pastor told us how difficult it was for him to share with them the gospel. And so as we go up, they welcomed us. Hospitality is a key part of this culture, and so they wanted to treat us as honored guests, and they did that by giving us the soup that they had made. I don't really know what was in the soup. I could see vegetables and hominy and chunks of meat, but don't really know anything about it. And we were warned by the pastor that they're not ranchers in this clan. They're up in the hills, and so they don't really raise animals. So that means meat is scarce. So it's a really special treat that they're giving us this, something that is a tremendous treat for them. They're using on us as their guests. It was this incredible way to honor us. But with that, any meat that they ate came from what they could hunt, which in this part of remote Arizona includes almost exclusively animals that we don't tend to eat. And so, because of that, some of the people that I was with tried to be as polite as possible, but refused the soup that was offered to them. All conversation was shut down at that point. Not a single word. There's no gospel conversations whatsoever. These people were trying to honor us. They gave us the best of what they had, something that's a gift for them, a treat for them, and they wanted to honor us with giving it. And so the refusal to eat it was seen as the greatest of all insults, and there was no more conversation. It completely put an end to it. And all this for a soup that wasn't all that bad. It was bland, but it didn't lead to intestinal issues or anything like that. But Paul, like us in Arizona, has things that he expects. He has preferences. He knows what he can eat and what he wants to eat. He knows what he can do and what he wants to do. But when we meet people who are not Christians, they have their own list of rights and preferences and freedoms and desires and practices. So something's got to give. And Paul says, it will always be me. And Paul says, Christian, it should always be you. Because this is the greatest of news that there is. The gospel is the good news of the good work that Jesus has done to save, and we should have nothing put an end to conversation like that. Nothing act as an obstacle to them hearing this incredible news of what Jesus has done for them. We should let nothing be a barrier from them receiving this love and grace and mercy from the God who tremendously loves this whole world. And as we've said, there's no freedom. There's no right, there's no preference, there's no desire that is worth more than someone's soul. What we're talking about is someone's soul. It's only the gospel, through the work of Jesus, that we are saved. So it's only the gospel that should be our priority. And maybe there's an objection that we might have here, and probably an objection that Paul faced as well. Like as he's talking about what he's doing for the Jews and those under the law and not under the law and for the weak, it seems like a little bit of a defense. He was probably accused of being inconsistent, of just giving in to peer pressure, of just doing what other people want him to do. And probably these people in the church who felt this freedom, these rights, probably would have had a complaint against Paul. You have been set free from Jesus. You're not living under that. You're living a lesser life than what you're called to do. Why are you doing this? That's not the right thing to do. Demand what is yours. And yet what Paul is doing as he continues his argument is showing he's not losing anything in this process. Even as he's giving up his rights, even as he's trying to be with these people who are around him, he's not losing himself. He's not acting inconsistent when he's with non-Christians. Rather, he's consistent in showing that nothing should interfere with the gospel. That as he gives up these rights and preferences and desires, he's actually not losing. As he's letting go of these things, he's not losing what is true, what is real. He's not changing the message of the gospel. We read about Paul, even when he's with non-Christians, he's holding for what is true. He's calling out, he's correcting people. He's righting wrong behavior. He's doing all of that. Certainly, the gospel message itself will be offensive to some. Die to yourself, live for Jesus. People don't want to do that. His point, though, is that we should not add to it. We should not add obstacles that are not there by trying to insist upon what we feel we're due to at the expense of other people. He's not letting anything prevent non-Christians from hearing this message that goes out to all people. So while Paul acts as sort of a cultural chameleon, he's able to adapt to whatever environment he's in for the sake of the gospel, he's not a karma chameleon. He's not one who just gives in. He sucks up to people. He's not changing the message of the gospel itself. He's not losing out on what is true, but he's contextualizing this truth. He's helping people realize, what does this look like right where they are? He's building these bridges for the gospel so that they might believe what is true for them as well. Now, this is difficult to do, because as we seek to be all things to all people, there's a good chance that we might just look like the all people, that we might lose the distinctiveness of Christianity as we seek to adapt and meet these preferences of others, to help them see what is true and real. What this takes is self-control and discipline to remain both faithful to the life that Jesus has called us to do, but also faithful to this command that he gives to every single Christian to make disciples of all nations. That takes self-control and discipline to maintain both those things. And to illustrate this, Paul switches to illustrations that come from the world of sports, much to the rejoicing of some in the room and maybe the groaning of other people. And yet, with him using these illustrations, they would have had a particular resonance. They would have impacted the Christians in Corinth in a particular way. When we think about sports in the ancient world, maybe we think of the Olympics. We know that that has a lengthy history. And it actually existed about 800 years before Paul writes this letter, continues another 300 years until it's outlawed and doesn't come back until a somewhat modern era. But at this time, in this culture that Paul is writing to, the second most popular sporting event took place in the city of Corinth. I try to think of what the equivalent is, because they're doing the same sports at the Olympics in Corinth. And so I was like, oh, it's like the World Championships to the Olympics, but no one actually watched the World Championships. That illustration fell apart. So I don't know, like it's March Madness to the Super Bowl, kind of that equivalent. They called these games the Isthmus Games, because Corinth is on an isthmus, this small channel of land between two different bodies of water. And it took place every 2 years. There's a good chance Paul was in Corinth when one of the years the Isthmus Games were going on. And the people in Corinth loved these games, either because they would go and watch it themselves, or because they brought tourism and income and employment to their city. And so it was deeply impactful. And so when Paul switches to these sports illustrations, he's pulling on important strings for the Corinthians. He's helping to illustrate this in a way that makes sense to them, that's a shared experience for them, that they would be very much so aware of. Like if we wanted to illustrate something in Colorado, we might mention hiking or skiing. Like those tend to be shared experiences for people here. Or in California, talk about going to the beach. In Minnesota, the misguided optimism of postseason success followed up by just never winning a championship in anything ever, that's a shared experience there. But what Paul is using these illustrations for is to say that even though he's giving up his freedoms, even though he's giving up what he has a right to, he's doing so with self-control. He's remaining disciplined. He's practicing self-restraint. Otherwise, he would lose himself in trying to become all things to all people. It is building these bridges, but remembering what the sure ground that he has been saved on. And so he talks about the Christian life as being like that of an athlete, of a runner trying to win, of a boxer who's not merely play acting, he's not shadow boxing, but doing the real thing. And his point in doing so is to make us think of all the discipline, the sacrifice that it takes to be an athlete at such a high level. Maybe we don't even have to think all that hard. We recently had the Olympics. And one of the things that Olympic broadcasters love to do is to do those human interest stories, that when one of the top athletes in the world is about to do their race or competition, whatever it looks like, but they're not from American, we just pipe a story over them of our American hero, and we look at all that they've had to endure, all the hardship that they've gone through, all the adversity that they've overcome. Maybe they lost 4 years ago, but now they're coming back stronger because of that. Let alone the thousands of hours that go into practicing their sport. the special diets that they have to do, and cutting out so much of life that we take as normal ourselves so that they could have one goal, one thing that they are focused on, and that is success, a chance to win gold. And Paul's point in verse 25, he says, every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. See, all these athletes at the Isthmus Games, they do it for a chance to win a laurel wreath that they would wear on their head. And Paul's point is, even before it goes on their head, this reward, this prize that they get, it's dying. It's decaying. It's been cut from the branches. It is going to die. And that's what they're trying to win. Even the gold medal, it'll last a little bit longer, hopefully, than the wreaths. I think the bronze medals didn't last as long as wreaths do, if I recall the story from the last Olympics. But even the gold medals, they are not permanent. They are decaying. They are disposable. And Paul's point is, if that is the discipline that it takes to go after something that is perishable, how much more disciplined ought we be when the stakes are someone's soul? For them seeing the gospel truth themselves, them being saved from sin and death and punishment. But not just that, the reward that's on hand for those who faithfully follow Jesus is eternal. For those who follow him, who remain with him, the reward is eternal. So how much more disciplined ought we be in the Christian life? How much more aware, should we be concerned about remaining faithful, how much self-control ought we have if those are the prizes? That as we seek to build bridges, to make disciples, as we let go of our rights and our preferences, we need this sort of self-awareness of what's going on in our life, of where we might be tempted or where we might go away from the truth ourselves. To be reminded of what the gospel is, how it shaped us as we try to help others to see the same truth. And think about it this way. How much self-control does a Christian need when they're constantly surrounded by other Christians? Like if we build for ourselves a world to where we never go away from a Christian community, if all that we do is we're around other people who believe in Jesus, how much self-control do we need at that point? I mean, still some, like we're all sinful people, but we have people who can constantly remind us of what's true. We have people who can point us back to what the gospel message is and how that's our baseline. We're surrounding ourselves with others who can hold us accountable. And when that's the case, if that's what we're used to, well, then we could get a little bit lax in our discipline. We can start to get comfortable. And when we're comfortable, we like maintaining that comfort. And so we talk about things that we're used to, things that we come to expect, our preferences, what's ours by right. See, we don't need all that much self-control when we're surrounded by other Christians, and yet it could push us to a place that's being described in this passage. On the other side, how much self-control do we need when we leave that bubble, when we go around non-Christians, when we try to become all things to all bridges, when we try to adapt to whatever their preferences are? It's really easy to just start to look identical to the culture around us and miss the truth that has saved us. So we need discipline in that time to remember what the content of the gospel is that we're trying to save people to not lose the distinctiveness of Christianity and what is life-giving about it. See, there's a tension in this passage. This whole argument that Paul is describing describes two ways that are a common pull for every single Christian. It's a warning about being insular, of just looking for what is ours by right, what is due to us, of becoming comfortable and lax in our discipline. And so we need the reminder that we are called to be part of making disciples of all nations. That is what Jesus has given every single Christian as the role that we are to live out of. But on the other side, as we go to do that, we need the discipline to not lose this distinctiveness that he has called us to, this new life that he's given as he has saved us from the life of sin and death and sorrow. But even in this, as Paul is describing this, of what the Christian life looks like, he constantly reminds us why this is. It's never go and do better. go out of your own strength. That's not possible, and that's not what Paul calls us to. He reminds us why this is what we are to do. Now, I describe the two reasons that he gives us in this passage as we labor out of love. So his whole point in this section, I think, is letting go, but not losing. We labor out of love. This is what the call of the Christian is. We talk about the laborer piece, that the role that's given to us is to make disciples. And he talks about what happens when we are faithful in this role or not faithful. Verse 23, he talks about, I do all this for the sake of the gospel that I may share with them and its blessings. But then on the other side, in verse 27, he says that I discipline my body, keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. A positive and a negative way to say the exact same thing. The point that Paul is making here is, why do we run? Why do we box? Why do we labor in this way to tell others about the gospel, willing even to let go of our rights and freedoms, things that are due to us? Well, when we do this, when we are faithful in this way, we're actually participating in the gospel work itself. We're demonstrating that the saving work that we are telling others about is real and alive in our lives as well. See, when we are faithful to labor in this way, to help others to see this good news, we are saying that we have felt the same saving effects that Jesus has done for us, that it's producing, it's changing the very way that we live our lives. As we see what has been done, that causes a response in our lives. Paul talks about this all over the place. We saw it recently in chapter 6. He says, for you were bought with a price. You have been saved by Jesus. You were bought with a price. So in response to that, as a result of that, glorify God with your body. Paul is saying that we labor in this way. We run this race. We live as we've been called to because we're demonstrating of what has been done for us. That as we recognize how beautiful it is, as we taste of the beauty of the truth of the gospel ourselves, this produces a change in ourselves that we live out of. That as we live in this way, we labor, we do this work because we recognize there's no room to be lax in our discipline. There's no room to lack this awareness of ourselves. There's no possibility of being passive for those who have seen the gospel. That drives us to live in this way. That drives this as a response. Paul talks about he felt compelled to speak and preach the gospel. Well, if we know the gospel, we have that same compulsion. Not as a requirement, not as a responsibility, but because we've seen the beauty of what has been done for us, and that changes everything. And yet it's also a labor out of love. We don't see this as a requirement that's put on us, but a response. It's not an obligation, but an opportunity to help people see the very same saving work that we cling to as well, to experience the very same thing that has been done for us. Because we recognize out of love that we, like them, were once lost. We, like them, could not save ourselves. We, like them, are broken in a broken world. We, like them, need the perfect God to put us back together. We, like them, are loved by God, and so we desire for them to know this gospel truth as well. Little question for us. For those of us who are following Jesus, one question. It's a one question pop quiz for you. Is our love for the lost increasing or decreasing? Does our desire to see people saved by the gospel, especially the people that have been put in our life, that we know, that we rub shoulders with, that we care about, do we desire for them to know this saving work as well, more than anything else? Does our heart break when there are people that we love, that we care about, that are in our life who do not know this? And apart from this saving work of Jesus, have that future of not being saved by him, well, that's sin. That's death, that's punishment. And does our heart break at that reality? Our desire to see them follow him more than anything else. If we answer no to that, if it's not increasing, we might be too comfortable. We're lax in our discipline. We don't see the significance of the gospel. Nothing is more important than the gospel. In the church, and outside the church. I don't want us to respond to that if we say no or if it's not as much of an awareness for us. I don't want us to respond with feeling beat up or, all right, I got to go. I got to work harder. As if the expectation is for us out of our own strength to go and save our whole neighborhood, our whole class, our whole team, the entire office that we work out of. That's not it at all. But I want us to look back at what Jesus has done for you. That is what drives us. That is what brings about this compulsion to help others to see this gospel as well. When we recognize how good the good news is, that changes our very desires in life, our aim, our willingness to do whatever we can, not to save everybody. Paul calls for us to recognize that we are worked through by God to save some. God is working in you to save some. You are the instrument that he is working through to save some. Not by your own strength, not by your own power, but by the very means that you have been saved, that is our means to go and see who has God put in my life to draw near to himself. We're still in January. January is a great time for setting goals for the year. We can count the last couple weeks as a gimme, but as we're thinking about what are we looking for in this year, I might push us towards this passage. Who are those some that God might be working through you to save in your life? Who are the people that our hearts break because they do not know the saving work of Jesus yet? And my encouragement for you is to pray for them. First and foremost, that this might be the year that that they see the God who's always been pursuing them. And whether that's through you or someone else, that they would be brought near, they would experience the saving work of the gospel. But as we're praying for them, as we're regularly reminding ourselves of them in our lives, I think that this could be a great way to remind ourselves to steer conversation towards spiritual conversations. That so often it's just easy to kind of go through the motions when we're talking with people, especially people we're comfortable with, that we know. So we just kind of talk about things. But as we're praying for them, as that's a regular reminder for us, as they're coming more to our mind than they would otherwise not, if we're not praying about them, this could be the reminder to talk about things that matter, talk about things that are valuable. As they share experiences or heartbreak or disappointment, to ask, what is good? What is something that you're excited about? What is something that's valuable to you? And then to point back to about how we are changed, we're shaped, we're guided by Jesus. One of the things that I'm looking forward to is for Jesus to create more patience in my life, for me to get more connected in the church. Just talk about things that are the results of being with Jesus and help people see how they can be included in the good work that's been done for them as well. It doesn't need to be bashing them over the head of, you're a sinner, you need to change, but I have experienced Jesus' love, and this is what it looks like. And I hope you can see how compelling and captivating that is, because it's the same love for you as well. I want to leave us with a quote from a man named C.T. Studd. Studd very much so lived up to his name, it seems like. He was an athlete. He was a cricket star. I don't know what cricket is either, but apparently he was internationally famous. He represented England at the highest level in playing the sport. He was wealthy, which I think is redundant when we said he's a cricketer. I assume they're just one and the same. But he also went to a study at Cambridge University. He was very wise, very wealthy. He had an entire life that sure looked like it was set up well from the outside. And he gave it all up to go and be a missionary in China, amongst other places. He saw this labor of love. He was captivated by the gospel and wanted others to see how compelling it was as well. Now, that might not be your call. Very few of us are called to go somewhere else, but to recognize that the place where God has you is the place where he is working through you. But he speaks of this place of every Christian, wherever it might be, when he said this. He said, "Let us not glide through this world and then slip quietly into heaven without having blown the trumpet loud and long for our Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Let us see to it that the devil will hold a thanksgiving service in hell when he gets the news of our departure from the field of battle." That's our race. That's what it is to win. And this is all because of the salvation that's been won for us in Jesus Christ. Let me pray for us. Father, we're grateful for your word that you give us in the Bible. That even though it's specific to a particular context that the church in Corinth was dealing with, a struggle that we tend not to, at its heart, at its roots, is something that impacts every Christian in every place. So we're grateful that we can turn to you for guidance and direction as people who are easily distracted or overwhelmed by the needs at hand. You constantly share, you constantly remind us of what is true and what is real and what is good. And we recognize that the greatest thing in our lives is the very means that we have been saved through and saved for. Your gospel, your good news, your saving work is what enables us to be in right relationship with you. And it's also what drives us, compels us to help others see that very same thing. And we need your guidance. We need your strength, your encouragement, your words to what to say. And yet, that is what you give to us as well. You help us to live from faith to faith, from your work and through your work. All things are yours. All things are from you. And so we turn to you, God, grateful and thankful for your faithfulness, desiring to be faithful in response. So it's to you and you alone we pray. Amen.